You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto Rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up. The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Hey there, folks. It's Ben Mathis here. In case you missed my big announcement the other day, I have some exciting news to share with you. We're starting a podcast network. This is something that's been a long time in the making, and now at last, in early May, we'll be launching our own network called Airwave. It'll be the new home for Kick-Ass News, as well as a number of your other favorite podcasts and brand new shows from some of the leading thought leaders and storytellers in audio entertainment, including podcasts from at least a dozen of my most popular past guests. We'll have 15 different podcasts at launch and plan to roll out over 40 shows in 2021. In the next few weeks, I'll be sharing more details about those specific shows, so subscribe to us on Twitter and Facebook at Airwave Podcasts. But in the meantime, I'm going to ask for your help. I'm putting a lot of my own money into covering the startup costs of this new venture, but we need additional financial support to cover our full production slate for 2021. So please visit GoFundMe.com/Airwave to contribute to what we're building here. That's GoFundMe.com/Airwave to donate. GoFundMe.com/Airwave. AIRWAVE. GoFundMe.com/Airwave. Thanks for your support and for listening all these years.
I'm half white, half Filipino. That's what I am. Which means my dad was in the military. That's not even a joke. That's real shit. A lot of soldiers were fighting for this country. My dad was dating. I'm his Purple Heart. My dad would say borderline racist shit to me when I was a kid. Borderline racist shit. But I knew he was joking. It's my dad. Just sitting at the dinner table, was like, you know why I married your mom, right? I'm like, why? Because I love Chinese food. She's Filipino, Dad.
That was comedian Joe Coy from his Netflix special, Coming In Hot. As one of today's premier stand-up comics, Joe Coy has come a long way from his modest beginnings performing at a Las Vegas coffee house. These days, he sells out arenas and theaters across the world and now has 3 Netflix specials under his belt. But he never forgets where he came from. In fact, his Filipino roots, culture, and especially his Filipino mom continue to be a source of endless inspiration for his comedy. And now he writes about his mom and dad, growing up as a biracial kid in America, combating racism in Hollywood, and finding his voice as a comedian in a new memoir called Mixed Plate, Chronicles of an All-American Combo. And today he comes on the podcast to open up about his early years traveling around the country as a military brat, his mom's legendary immigrant hustle, and his first taste of the spotlight as a childhood Michael Jackson impersonator. He recalls selling tickets door-to-door for his first comedy show, how he practically hounded Netflix into giving him his first stand-up special, and how today he uses his fame to help promote other Filipino artists and comedians. Plus, Joe talks about embracing our stereotypes, Filipino crucifixion rituals, and why there really are so many Filipino nurses out there. Coming up with Joe Coy in just a moment. Joe Coy is one of today's premier stand-up comics who entertains audiences across the world. His 2017 Netflix special, Joe Coy, Live from Seattle, was so successful that he released a follow-up sequel in 2019, and his 2017 Break the Mold tour sold out so many shows in Honolulu that the mayor proclaimed November 24th Joe Coy Day. In 2018, he was named Stand-Up Comedian of the Year by the Montreal Just for Laughs Festival. And now he tells his story in a memoir that is both touching and hilarious, titled Mixed Plate, Chronicles of an All-American Combo. Joe Coy, welcome to the podcast.
I love you, man. Thank you so much.
Well, Joe, it's great to have you on the show, and I'm a fan of your act. So much of your comedy centers on your family, your parents, and the fact that you are the product of a biracial marriage. Tell us about your mom and dad. In many ways, they couldn't have been more different, right?
Oh God, how do I say, I don't want to make my dad out to be like this bad guy, but you know, back then the man was kind of just bi, you know what I mean? And just, and left my mom to raise me, you know what I mean? And the sisters. So, you know, if you could just, I always say this to my son, if you could just imagine the times that we lived in, there were no Instagram and Facebook or anything like that. You know, you're just talking about a Filipino immigrant woman that comes to this country, no friends, no family. And next thing you know, she's by herself with some kids. So
yeah,
just imagine how that was for her. And that's what this book explains. Cause you know, maybe that'll help you understand why I talk about her so much on stage.
And I'm curious, is your dad still with us? And do you two have any kind of a relationship these days?
Oh, most definitely. That's why I'm always careful with my words. Don't get me wrong. He knows I used to curse him a lot when I was a kid. You know, I told him to his face how mad he made me, you know, but, you know, that's life. We're allowed to make mistakes. But my dad has been the most, he's an angel now, you know what I mean? He's been in my life, that time when they were divorced was a very troubling time for the whole family. And it was a great deal of depression that I had to deal with, and comedy was my outlet. And then reuniting with my dad, you know, in my 20s was heavenly, you know what I mean? I finally got that father figure, back in my life, even though my stepdad, you know, Fred, my mom's second husband, was, you know, he was like my angel, you know what I mean? But it was always good to have my father back in my life.
Yeah. Yeah. And your mom and dad met when he was in the military and stationed in the Philippines, right?
Yeah. So, military, you know, I say this joke on stage, man. You know, military, God bless the military, because if it wasn't for the military, there wouldn't be a mixed race. And I mean that from the bottom of my heart, because when I used to live on the bases, yeah, here's another thing that I, you know, living with my son, you know, he's got all these kids that are brown color, mixed color. Like, it's a thing now. It's not a thing, but that's life. Life has evolved. You know, my mom and dad met, you know, in the 60s. You know what I mean? Things were still new. You know, my dad grew up, graduated high school in the 50s. So it's like, you know what I mean? The tension, the racial tension, and then Asian and white, and making this thing that I had like almond eyes, but they were green. Like no one knew what I don't want to curse, but knew what I was. You know, so it was a different time. Like it's, you know, that mix was a crazy thing back then. Like everyone was always trying to figure out what I was. That's where that joke comes from. I hate keep doing my bits, but you know, when everyone would find out what I was half Asian, I'd get the worst compliments because they didn't know how to approach me. Oh my God, you're half Filipino. I love orange chicken. Like, what are you talking about? That's Chinese. What are you talking about? But yeah, so it's like, you know, when you know, if it wasn't for the military, you wouldn't have people like myself, or you wouldn't have Tiger right. Woods.
Right, right.
You know, and so thank God for the military,
yeah.
man.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting. In the book, you make that distinction between living on the base versus living off the base and yeah. how differently you were treated. You said that you felt more comfortable as a mixed race kid on the military base than you did. Whoa. Out in public.
1 billion percent. 1 billion. That was my comfort zone. Because we didn't know, you know, when you're on the base, it's very isolated. It's a base. It's got gates and, you know, armed guards out front. You don't get the general population coming in. This right. is a selected few, you know, it's the military and it's our own world. We have our own commissary. We got our own, you know, shopping center. We got everything. And when you see all these soldiers walking around with their new wives from other countries and they're having their kids, we all just looked at each other like normal. You know, it was normal for me to see a black kid mixed with a German, you know, German black and Latino white and Asian white. And, you know, that was normal on the base. So like, I grew up seeing that and it was normal. Not normal to me was getting off base and people looking at me and my mom weird. That was weird yeah. to me. And as a kid, you don't know what racism is, man. Mm-hmm. Racism is taught, you know, you right. learn that. And when you see people reacting the way, you know, I talk about it in the book, but as a kid, I just thought it was like, oh, that kid pulled his eyes back, mom. But my mom is like, she's got to be able to take it and also know that she has a kid that she has to protect, you know, mm-hmm. and not
yeah.
let them know what that is, you know? So yeah, big kudos to my mom, man. Cause you know, writing that book brought back some memories. And I remember that vividly, like, it, you know, it's like PTSD. Like I still remember, you know, what that little hint of racism was yeah. going up the escalator.
Now, what would you say when kids asked, what are you? Did you have a quick comeback for that? Or,
you know, when I was a kid, I didn't understand it. I felt like yeah. I was this ambassador, man, you know, because, you know, my mom would be on campus and she's Filipino and, you know, no one knew what the hell that was. Everyone only knew Japanese, Chinese. It was like the really? When you said Filipino, they were like, huh? What is that? And then I got to explain my food. What kind of food you guys eat? And I got to explain that. They're like, ugh. So it's not chow mein? Like, no, it's not chow mein. Like my whole life, that's what it was. That's, you know, yeah. that's, you know, that's why when I shot my Netflix special in the Philippines, people were like, oh, you went to the Philippines. Here he goes. And I'm like, no, I went to the Philippines, man, because I live in America. And to this day, I don't have representation, man. Mm-hmm. Like that's what this whole country's about, man. Like we yeah. all live together. We're all mixed races. We're all from other countries, and let's learn about each other. Why is it always got to be this thing about you're in America now? Why do you got to go to the Philippines and do your special? Because, man, I want the world right. to know what my roots are, who I am. It gives me an identity. And there's other kids that are Filipino that live here that don't have things to look mm. up to on television. And that's, you know, thank God I was able to do that. So, and yeah. thank you Netflix for investing the way they did and letting me, go to the Philippines and shoot that, because that was not cheap.
Yeah, I'll bet. And I love that special because you really not just showcased your own talents, but the talents of all kinds of people from the Philippines.
All
who
of
were
them.
Singers, dancers, even showcased Filipino food. That must have been an interesting moment for you. Meaningful.
Yeah, man. I had one hour to express how I truly feel about my mom's country and my, you know, my ethnicity. And I wanted to show it all, man. You know, all those times people ask me, what kind of food do you eat? I wanted to show just 5 minutes of our food. If I can just show 5 minutes of how delicious our food looks and show my aunt, yeah. my aunt cooked it with my sister. And, you know, I went to the Philippines and showed these little kids that were rapping, you know, the rappers in the Philippines, you know what I mean? Where opportunity doesn't come. And we were able to put them on the world stage, like Netflix, these little kids, you know, rapping,
you know, in front of millions of people. And that made me feel good. Now that, by the way, just a little side note, those kids just signed a deal with Def Jam Records.
Wow.
So that was a beautiful thing. And thank God for Netflix incredible. To be able to showcase their talent like that. And then, of course, the Filipino kids that lived in America that performed and did stand-up. Like, they didn't even know what the Philippines was. They didn't even know if they would
angle.
Understand the jokes. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to bring them on and provide that opportunity. Illmind, the producer, he got a Grammy for Beyonce and Jay-Z, and he's Filipino. And I was like, man, I would love for you to just produce some of the songs for these kids in the Philippines. And he jumped on board. So it was like this whole Filipino love. The cameramen's were Filipino. My DJ Cherish, the other DJ that was on, the B-Boys, they were all Filipino. So I was just so honored and happy, man. Sorry, you got me excited.
No. It was a great special. And I have to wonder, you did mention that was not a cheap special to do. I wonder, was it a tough sell when you first approached Netflix about shooting in the Philippines?
You know what? First of all, it was a tough sell for me to get into Netflix. People don't know this. They didn't give me a special. So they said no to me like 10 times. And yeah, I exaggerate, by the way, every time. I always say, they said no to me 5 times. They said no to me 10 times. I can't wait to see when I'm like 80. I'm gonna be like, they said to me 100 times. They said no. But they said no to me so many times. And then to the point where they were like, hey, quit asking. Literally, they were like, "We're done. We have all the talent that we want for our stand-up specials for 2017, and we'll look at you in 2018." And I wanted to be on 2017. Everyone was going to be on 2017. Dave Chappelle, Chris Rock, Jerry Seinfeld, Ray Romano. I mean, all these big names were going to be on 2017, and I wanted to be on that. And the only way I could have done it is if I shot it myself, and that's what we did. Me and my manager, made it happen. We shot that special. That was 100% me, man. If you watch Live from Seattle, I was broke on stage. I'm telling jokes, but I had no more money. I spent everything. And when we cut it up, we brought it to Netflix, even though they said no. And they watched it, and immediately we got a phone call and went, we're buying it. So
wow.
There you go. So if, you know, a lot of people always go, oh, that's the reason why he's blown up, because he's on Netflix. No, I'm blown up because I made it happen, man. Mm-hmm. So
good for you.
You know,
man.
I'm not trying to pat myself on the back, but I am. But, you know, a lot of people in this business like to hear the words no, and mm-hmm. they get mad, and their initial reaction now is to go on Twitter and cast hate on everybody.
Right. Right.
Instead, why don't you look at that no and use it as motivation to see why they can't just say yes. You know, and that's what happened. And thank God it happened, because I got Coming In Hot. Mm. And then after that, I pitched them In His Elements in the Philippines, and they bought it right away, man. They were like, we love that idea.
Yeah, good for you. But that's not the first time that you've had to sort of do that. I think in the book you talk about how you rented out a theater for a one-man stand-up show and sold tickets door to door. Was it
door
a thing where the business was not going to let just open up the door for a Filipino comic? So you just kind of had to make your own opportunity for yourself?
Make it yourself, man. Yeah. You know what I was noticing in Vegas is I was opening for these headliners, and they would give me 2-for-1s and hand out all these 2-for-1s to everybody. And I would notice every night that pretty much 70% of the crowd were the 2-for-1s I handed out to my friends. And, you know, no disrespect to the headliner, but there was no pull or effort on his part. So I was just like, why am I giving him all the money? You know what I mean? Like, I don't get it. Like, I can do this. And so I went and rented out theaters. And when I say door to door, you know, I had to cut my tickets at Kinko's. These young kids don't know what Kinko's is, but it's a Xerox copy place. And you make a flyer and then you cut up these tickets. I would make 8 tickets to a page and cut them on those straight cutters.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
All my tickets would be, they wouldn't even be straight. Some would be at an angle, and it was bad. But what I meant by door to door is, you know, when I would work at these hotels, and, you know, there's a ton of them. There's thousands of people working at hotels, and literally I would walk up to everybody, you want to go to my comedy show? And they would always say, yeah, just see me on Friday. Bro, I would go up to them on Friday. If I had to go to their house, I would knock on the door. Hey, man, you said you wanted the tickets. I just need 14 bucks. I swear to God, man, I'm not lying. I go, I don't even care if you don't go. Just give me the $14. I got to pay these comics, and I got to pay for this venue, man.
Yeah.
But I need this 14 bucks, man. And I literally, I would go door to door up until I got on stage, man. Swear. Wow. I would sell that joint
out. That's impressive. Yeah, I mean, it's a good thing that you weren't doing that. Now that you're popular, you would have people like counterfeiting your tickets. That would be very easy, I imagine. So. Yeah.
It's crazy.
In your act, you express mad respect for your mom's hustle and say that's where you get it from.
Yeah.
And she has had this determination to achieve her idea of the American dream. Give us some examples of that side of her.
I always tell people, and here I go again, I keep referring back to Facebook and Instagram, and you know, it's easier. If you move to this country naked with no friends, no family, you can literally go on Facebook and find friends in about 5 minutes that like the stuff that you like, talk the way that you talk, same ethnicity. If you want to be around your people, find out where all the restaurants are that serve your food, which is very important. It's a beautiful thing. My mom didn't have any of that. And people always seem to forget that, man. When my mom came here, she came with nothing. You know, she had a husband, they divorced, and now she's by herself with these kids, and she wants a community that speaks her language and eats her food. Mind you, there were no Filipino restaurants back then. There ain't there's hardly any Filipino restaurants now. So
right.
Imagine but the ones that are how it was are in the 70s and 80s.
Yeah.
So like we would do these potlucks at the Knights of Columbus after church. And she would literally walk up to Filipinos at church. If she looked at someone at church that looked Filipino, she'd walk right up to them at the end. Filipino ka? Are you Filipino? And, you know, sometimes they're Mexican. Sometimes she didn't care. She was racial profiling. She didn't care. She just wanted to meet a Filipino. And every time she would meet a Filipino, they became the best of friends, man. And next thing you know, we started renting out the Knights of Columbus, and they were doing potluck nights. Everyone brought a Filipino dish, and you know, it was our Sunday escape from where we were living and just enjoying our culture. And literally my mom would be like the organizer of it, you know, and she would make me and my sister perform. I would dance. My sister would sing, and there would be food, and it was crazy. We'd have Christmas parties, and there'd be a Filipino Santa Claus. He was super skinny and brown with a beard that barely hung on his ears, but it was Christmas to us.
Yeah. In your book, you recall learning to impersonate Michael Jackson when you were a boy and say that it was sort of the best and worst day of your life.
How many times
did mom make you do Michael Jackson over the years?
Every time. I just found that glove. Literally, I was going through my memorabilia stuff, and I found the glove, and I put it in a case, and it like touched my heart, because I still remember my mom sewing each I don't know what they weren't, rhinestones, they were like this thing that like shined. If you shined a light on it, it shined, and she sewed on every single piece and made me this glove. And I remember I got ketchup on the fingertip, and she got so mad, man. She's like, oh my god, why did you eat the hot dog with your Michael Jackson glove? You have to perform. So yeah, it's crazy. I should have brought it out for you. It's so cool.
Were you a pretty good Michael Jackson impersonator? What was the act like?
Really? It was amazing. Oh, I brought the house down.
Yeah.
Crushed it.
We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll return with more when we come back in just a moment. Now, I'm curious, when did you first become aware of stand-up comedy, and who were the comics that you gravitated to when you were young?
The first one I ever heard, of course, was Richard Pryor. My friend William, his dad had a Richard Pryor tape. He's the one that was like, you should be a comedian. When I was like 10, he was like, man, you should be a comedian. His older brother was the one that actually said the word comedian. I remember this vividly. And he was like, you should be a comedian. I was like, what's a comedian? He's like, those guys that tell jokes on stage. And then they got the Richard Pryor tape. I kept listening to it. And then Eddie Murphy, it was over. Eddie Murphy, Delirious, HBO, man, 1980, 81, I can't remember. But when I saw that, done.
Yeah, classic.
It was over.
Yeah.
And then when I was 15, he went to the Seattle Coliseum, and he was on tour. It was called Raw. And I used my mom's credit card. And I called on the phone. This is before the internet. You know what I mean? This is before right. Ticketmaster.com. This was just some local business or whatever that was called Ticketmaster. You called on the phone and they had to go pick up your tickets at like Nordstrom, that customer service. And I remember calling and using an accent like, can I get tickets to Eddie Murphy? And they didn't even question if I was 14. They thought I was really a Filipino woman. Like, oh yeah, please. What's your credit card number? They sold me the tickets, man. So I saw Eddie at 15. Amazing. I think it was 15 when he finally got there.
Wow.
Yeah, man.
Now, when you were first considering a career in comedy, I mean, there were no Filipino American comics out there, at least none that you might see on The Tonight Show or I don't know, HBO Young Comedian specials. So I wonder if you found some inspiration in those 80s and early 90s comedians like Paul Rodriguez and Margaret Cho, who sort of paved the way and proved that comedy Ooh. About immigrant life wasn't just a niche thing.
Margaret was amazing. I'm going to say this, though, when my first inspiration on the big screen would be Dante Bosco, when he played Rufio on Hook. And I remember just going apeshit. You know what I mean? Like, oh, I'm sorry. Can you get that out?
No, you can say whatever you want. It's fine.
I just remember seeing that. And I was just so like, because he was so brown. He was so like, I knew when I looked at him, I was like, that dude's Filipino. He looked like my mm-hmm. uncle. You know what I mean? Even though he was only like 16, he looked like my uncle. Like, that's what my uncle looks like. You know what I mean? Like, he's so dark and the hair and, you know, the way he spoke, I could tell, even though he spoke English, I could tell there was a little bit of an accent in there. You know what I mean? And he was so inspirational for me, like, which is so crazy because it was Hook, which is Steven Spielberg. And, right. and now here I am now, I got to deal with Steven Spielberg now in a movie. So it's so cool how it comes full circle.
Yeah.
But as far as comedian is concerned, Rob Schneider was the one that was like, really? When I found out he was Filipino, same thing on the big screen.
I did not know that at all.
Oh, really? Yeah. He's half. He's mixed. Didn't know that. Yep. Okay. And, yeah, obviously his last name Schneider. but his mom was Filipino. And I remember watching a movie on a date. And I think it was called, I'm going to say Deuces Bigelow. I'll just say it. I don't know if that's
Deuce
the movie.
Bigelow. Yeah, yeah.
But
Deuce Bigelow, male gigolo. I remember.
Yeah,
that
one. I think it's that movie when his dad walks into the scene and he goes, "Your mom made your favorite dessert, raspberry babinka." And when he said babinka, I lost my mind in the theater. And I remember looking at everybody going, "That's a Filipino dessert."
Yeah.
That his mother is Filipino. My mom's like literally. I remember tugging the guy sitting next to me. And I was just like, babinka is Filipino. Like I had to make sure everyone knew what babinka was. And I was so proud. And that was the day I found out that he was half Filipino. Cause he's so,
I didn't know.
You know, he's got the big blue eyes and you couldn't tell that he was Filipino, but man, when I found out it was over, over.
When did you first get serious about comedy? And also talk about how your mom reacted when she heard that news.
Oh man. When I told her I wanted to be a comic, she cried, first of all, and then it was done. It was like, it was literally 15 years of me proving to my mom that this was the right decision. And every year, it felt indirectly being reminded that this is the worst decision. You don't have insurance. You don't have, what will you do when you retire? Like, are you going to tell jokes when you're 85? Like, it was just nonstop. Yeah. And, you know, it really hurt. There were times where I did want to listen to my mom and quit, but, I knew I was on the right path and it was that extra fire inside me mm-hmm. to prove to my mom that this was the right decision, that this is what I was born to do.
Yeah, and it's kind of ironic because you describe your mom as a natural born entertainer and you talk about how she kind of had this wild side in her early years in the Philippines. She even managed a band and then she came to America and got quote unquote a real job in a bank. I wonder if there's a part of you that sort of mourns that side of her and maybe even as a result rebelled against taking the practical route in life?
No, I mean, it was hard for me to understand coming from an immigrant mom that comes to a country of opportunity, you know, and always having to remind their kids where they came from, you know, and to take advantage of this situation and just the pressure as a Filipino mom, you know, the one thing that they want to just like take to their grave is that their kids were successful and they didn't have to see the struggle that they saw, mm-hmm. you know, when they were kids. And now I understand that as a parent, you know what I mean? And yeah. so I could just only imagine the pressure that she had as a parent. You know what I mean? Sure. Like, just go to college. I don't want to worry about you. I get it now. I get it. Like, you know, I'm having meetings with my son's, you know, principal the other day. And it's just like, I get it. You know what I mean? Like, Joe, just graduate high school, please. You know what I mean? So I get it. There was a little extra pressure on her end, but you know, it was also a fire that burnt deep in my soul to really show my mom that this was the right decision. Mm-hmm. And to be able to provide for the family that the way that I do, you know?
Yeah. What was your first time doing stand-up in an actual comedy club?
I bombed tremendously. Right. It was a competition called, God, what was it called? It was called Star Mania. That's what it was called.
Yeah.
And I was at a bar and I had a pencil in my mustache because I was only 18. And I remember I was so scared because I remember the waitress goes, what would you like to drink? And I remember, oh, just water, because I didn't even want to give her a hint that I was a kid because I wanted to get on the stage. And I remember finally getting on stage. I did a stupid joke. It was about condoms, of course. What else are you supposed to talk about? And then the guy went up before me. He did a Lionel Richie impersonation. He crushed. Anyways, I'm back to my joke. I did a condom joke. It bombed so bad. My tongue started getting all chalky. Where it sticks to you, the roof of your mouth. Yeah. And then I had nothing because they weren't laughing at anything. And then finally I was trying to rip it. I go, man, your mouth gets so dry, your tongue sticks to the roof of your mouth. And this drunk lady at the bar yells out, put a condom on it. And the house erupts. This woman gets a standing ovation on the joke I bombed on.
Yeah.
It was just a double dagger, man. And yeah. I remember just walking off the stage and just my head held down. And I think I talk about this in the book too, but yeah. And I just remember that Lionel Richie impersonator, man, was so sweet to me. I wish I knew his name, man. Because he was the one that was like, hey, man, you didn't do good tonight, but I'll tell you what, you got good stage presence.
Oh, yeah?
He goes, yeah, it was just something about you on stage that was just, it was good. You got something. So that was sweet. Because if he didn't say that, I think I would have stopped.
Yeah.
I would have become a nurse.
Yeah, but you know what? Comedians always say it's better to bomb your first time out than to kill. Because then you'll always be chasing that the rest of your career.
Yeah. Exactly.
And it's going to hurt when you don't kill.
You don't want to. No. Yeah, you exactly. And yeah. Here's the thing, man. When you do finally kill, you start chasing that. Mm-hmm. You start chasing right. that and it's addicting. So it's my drug. It's my addiction, yeah. man. I can't get enough of it. I have to be on stage and you can put me up anywhere. I'll go up at a bar. I'll go up at a coffee house. I don't care. When I was on tour, I was playing arenas, you know, before the pandemic. I would literally try and find an open mic somewhere and just go up and, you know what I mean? It'd be a bar next to a keg. I didn't care. I love stand up that much. Yeah. I just love that fear that you have to conquer, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Whatever situation it is and being able to do it. Mm-hmm. I love it.
And now you say in the book that you encountered a fair deal of racism on your way up in Hollywood when you tried to pitch your act or your brand of humor for television. What did producers and executives say to you?
It just sucked, you know, and like, I'm not trying to cast any hate, you know, mm-hmm. like, I was mad, you know, yeah. I was mad at Netflix, but you know, it's just an obstacle, you know, and it's a door that needs to be kicked down And I'm happy I was able to kick some of those doors down and it just sucked, cause there was one deal that I had. I was with Tom Werner, you know what I mean? Who's a legend in the game, you know, Carsey Werner and legend in the game. And here he is giving me a deal and bringing me to all the networks, and pitching this show idea and got me a writer and everything. And every note was, we don't think middle America get it. And I was just like, what are you talking about? You know what I mean? Like, what do you mean? Like, middle America will get it. Like, we all live here together, man. You know, you may not know it, but we do.
Right.
People just don't like to hear it directly, but indirectly they get it. You know, when you go to the hospital, you do see a bunch of Filipino nurses, you know, they live among us. And so, and they don't have to have accents, you know? So I don't have an accent. It's you laugh because my mom is funny. Mm-hmm. And my mom is just like your mom. It's just, mine just happens to be Filipino. And that's my favorite part of, you know, being able to go on stage and tell those jokes, that being relatable is a lot more than what it is.
Well, you know, I almost wonder how much of that was racism and how much of it was just a byproduct of the lack of imagination and the tendency for film and TV execs to revert back to the old tested formula of, you know, it's X meets Y, The Godfather meets Good Will Hunting, it's Sleepless in Seattle in the Old West, you know, stuff like
you're
that.
You're right. You're right. Yeah. And what is that, right? Like,
just a lack of imagination.
A lack of imagination. And ignorance is not a bad word. You know what I mean?
Right.
It's just, you don't know. And I'm ignorant at times. Of course, we all are. And you just don't know. So, you know, the key to, you know, crushing your ignorance is opening up and learning. Mm-hmm. It's not hard. It really isn't. You know, it takes it's pretty demeaning when someone goes, "What's that? What's that? Why do you say that so fast? Why don't you learn?" We have so many tools in front of us now to learn about everybody.
True.
You know, one thing that I love the most about In His Element, when it finally aired, and you know, I'm friends with Tommy Lee from Motley Crue.
Oh yeah.
And the coolest thing that he said to me was, I had no idea. One, he congratulated me on the special, and then he was just like, "Dude, watched it. I didn't know they speak English there. This is Tommy Lee, bro." Motley Crue. This guy has toured the world 1,000 times over, every country, and didn't know that people in the Philippines speak English. I even asked him, I go, "Did Motley Crue play the Philippines?" "No." "What?" And that's not, you know, and I'm not dogging Tommy, but that's the whole purpose of In His Element, is to open that the awareness, you know what I mean?
I don't know if
you know this, but Filipinos can sing. The lead singer of Journey is Filipino with the thickest accent. But when he sings, he sounds like Steve Perry. If Motley Crue would have went to the Philippines, they would have sold out, and they would have heard so many Filipinos singing those songs.
I think that there's like 180 different language or something like that. Different languages in the Philippines, right?
Yep.
It's amazing.
Yep, it's 180. And, you know, there's two that they speak, you know, very, you know, there's one that's national, Tagalog is their national, but there's a couple other that they speak fluently. And it's so crazy that English is one of them.
Yeah.
Nuts.
And now one of the things that's become a hallmark of your act is your embrace of, or at least acceptance of, stereotypes as sort of a reality of life. We all kind of stereotype one way or another. How would you sum up your philosophy about stereotypes?
Here's the thing, man. We live in a very sensitive time, and I get it. You know what I mean? And I'd be lying to you if I didn't say I wasn't sensitive, you know, but I also love identifying with certain stereotypes. If you look at my routine, bro, I'm calling out the obvious. Not all Filipinos are nurses, but a lot of them are.
Yeah.
And there's the joke. Unfortunately, it's a stereotype. You know what I mean? And if you could just hit it on the head and appreciate and embrace the stereotype, because there's nothing wrong with it. I love it. As long as it's funny, you know? Yeah. But if you're doing it to be offensive and mean, you know, and make someone feel small and little, then we have a problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But if you watch my Coming In Hot, when I do telling Asians apart through their accent, and only if they have their accent. Man, I do too. And one thing I love the most is I do it in a respectful way, and like getting the love from, like, when I do the Vietnamese joke, I mean, so much love from Vietnamese people. It's pathetic, man. It's overwhelming how much. And not only that, they get this representation, man. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Finally, we're being heard, bro. Like, definitely. Like, yeah, that's us, dude. You know what I mean? And they love it, you know? And when I do the Japanese, like, so many people are just casting love about it. And it's not being offensive. It's just like embracing the stereotype and having fun and enjoying it. And if you can't do that, man, then you can't live, man. Yeah. You just can't. It's exhausting.
Yeah. But I think you say that your mom actually wanted you to be a nurse instead of a comedian.
Where does that
come from? Why are so many Filipinos either nurses or I think you say mailmen's another thing?
you know what's crazy is it's the way out, man. And okay. They know that English is the way out, and they know that customer service and customer care and that field is very important. Mm-hmm. And it's good money. Okay. So, and they are very nice and beautiful, loving people. They care. They speak perfect English and they know that that's their way out to provide for their families, and nothing wrong with that. You know what I mean? There's nothing wrong with that. I'd be lying if you didn't think that Indians don't become doctors for the same reason. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, Irish became cops, you know, 100 years ago.
It's just something that's embodied in our culture, and there's nothing wrong with that. Yes, it's a stereotype, not all, generally speaking, but I'm not embarrassed by it. My mom wanted me to be a nurse, not a comic. I had to prove to her that this was the right decision.
Well, before we go, I understand that you're working on a movie based on your family's experience called Easter Sunday. And one thing I know about Philippines, and maybe this is a stereotype, is Easter is huge to them, way more than it is here in America. They even have that guy who literally crucifies himself every year. Yeah. Why is Easter such a big holiday over there?
Easter is the biggest holiday in the Philippines, hands down. They're very religious people. You know, that's the time to repent. You know what I mean? So all I know is that's the day. All I know. Okay. Because I'm supposed to be Catholic. But unfortunately, I'm only Catholic because my mom is. Culturally Catholic. And I do it because my mom does it. There.
Okay.
Unfortunately, Easter Sunday was the day to me to eat. Okay. And when all the family came over, so much food, so much chaos. Every aunt, every uncle, every cousin came to the house on Easter Sunday, and it was always chaos. There was always fights. There was always singing. There was always dancing. There was always drunk. So that's my story, and that's what I presented to Steven and Dan Lin, Steven Spielberg, and they love the story, and it's a great way of showing a little bit of our culture, a little bit of funny, and a little bit of love, and everything. So it all takes place on one day.
That's awesome.
The chaos all happens in one day.
Is there still a guy who crucifies himself every year? Because I think it was the same guy every year.
Yeah. No, it's not the same guy. It's always different guys. There's thousands of guys. It's everywhere.
Wow.
Everywhere.
I mean, you said Filipinos were performers, but talk about suffering for your art.
Well, it's not art. He's actually doing it. Like, you know, that's that. If you got to see
incredible.
It. As a kid, me and my sister saw it 3 or 4 times. And literally, there's thousands of these guys doing this to themselves. Wow. And it's right there in the streets.
Man. Well, once again, Joe's book is called Mixed Plate, Chronicles of an All-American Combo. And I also encourage folks to subscribe to his podcast, The Koi Pond. Joe,
I love it.
Thanks for talking with me.
Thank you so much.
Thanks again to Joe Koi for coming on the show. Order his book, Mixed Plate, Chronicles of an All-American Combo, on Amazon, Audible, or wherever books are sold. Subscribe to his podcast, The Koi Pond, wherever you like to listen, and keep up with him at joekoi.com or on Twitter at @joekoi. If you enjoyed today's podcast, be sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and rate and review us while you're there. 5-star ratings and detailed reviews are one of the best ways for new listeners to discover the show. You can also follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at @KickAssNewsPod and recommend us to your friends on your social media. For more fun stuff, visit kickassnews.com, and I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. For now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.